These are spring's final weeks, and as summer begins, we enter the high-risk season for Lyme disease. The infection is said to affect 300,000 people annually in the U.S., costing more than $1 billion in medical bills. Many patients have complained that they experience symptoms of the infection long after their prescribed treatments ran their course. In April, Johns Hopkins opened the Lyme Disease Clinical Research Center, the first of its kind, aimed at addressing the many controversial and unanswered questions about the infection and what has been called post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome. We'll hear from the research center's founder, Dr. John Aucott, and Midday contributor, Dr. John Smarr, trying to settle a question and come up with treatments. Midday on Health after the news. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. It's Dan Rodericks with you for the second hour and Midday on Health. Today is June 1st, which means summer is only a few weeks away. That transition into summer might be the highlight of the year for a lot of us as we take the family for a hike, maybe in Oregon Ridge Park, or go for a dip in the Gunpowder River. I saw a lot of people doing that yesterday. But it's also the season of highest risk for Lyme disease. For years, Lyme disease and its treatments have been controversial. Some believe there are too many undiagnosed cases, that there are not enough ways to sufficiently detect the infection early, and that there is a need for long-term treatments for Lyme disease. While the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says there are only 30,000, I shouldn't use the word only, there are about 30,000 reported cases of Lyme disease each year. That number does not reflect every case of Lyme that occurs in the country, according to the CDC. Preliminary results from three evaluation methods, including medical claims information and data obtained from surveys of laboratories, estimate that 300,000 people get Lyme disease each year. This is according to, the CDC. And according to those numbers, that would make Lyme disease the seventh most common infectious disease in the country. Other organizations, such as the National Institutes of Health, are skeptical of long-term treatments for the disease and avoid diagnosing illnesses that occur after one's been treated for Lyme disease. Different terms such as chronic Lyme disease or post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome are used to refer to the fatigue and pain that occur that's often reported by people who have been treated for Lyme disease with antibiotics. Those terms and the idea that the infection can continue after one has been treated with a prescription medication remain in debate. The National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases says the term chronic Lyme disease has been used to describe people with different illnesses. While the term is sometimes used to describe illness in patients with Lyme disease, on many occasions it has been used to describe symptoms in people who have no evidence of a current or past infection. Because of the confusion with how the term is employed, experts in this field do not support its use. So that's one perspective on it. On April 1st of this year, Johns Hopkins opened the Lyme Disease Clinical Research Center as part of the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. The center is the first of its kind and aims to answer questions surrounding the infection. We have with us on the show today Dr. John Aucott. Dr. Aucott is the director of this new clinic. He is the director of the Lyme Disease Clinical Research Center. That's part of the Division of Rheumatology at Johns Hopkins. So he's going to be joining us. First, I'd like to say hello to Dr. John Smarr, who's with us for another edition of Midday on Health. And John is a specialist in infectious diseases based at Sinai Hospital, joins us once a month here on the show. So it's nice to have you back on the show, John. Nice
of
to see
course,
you.
Of course, Dan. Absolutely. Tis the season, as you said.
It is. So Dr. Aucott is with us by phone, joining us to talk about the new center at Hopkins. Dr. Aucott, thank you for making time for us here on the Midday Show.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Let's talk about the goals of your clinic. So if you were to list the three priorities going into this research, what would they be?
So this is what's called a translational clinical research center, and that's a big word for meaning we bridge the patient illness and real patients to the basic laboratory facilities at Johns Hopkins. So it's uniquely a center that bridges those two aspects. And what that means is we see patients in research protocols define their illnesses very precisely, and then use blood samples from those research participants to look at the impact of disease on immune function and other aspects done down at the basic laboratories at Johns Hopkins. Our collaborator, Dr. Mark Schlosky, is an expert in immunology and is looking at the impact of Lyme disease on immune system function, and we have many other collaborators that are going to help us dissect out really what's happening in patients with Lyme disease and to get more precise definitions and terms for what I think you correctly said is really a mixed bag of diagnoses under that umbrella of chronic Lyme disease. Our goal is to dissect those out and precisely define what those different aspects might be.
Yeah, this is really interesting because over the last few years, in fact, John Smarr and I have talked about this, whether there is, in fact, chronic Lyme disease. One of the things you want to look at is why people continue to report symptoms after they've been through the antibiotic treatment, correct?
Exactly, and we do it in a way where we know for in fact that the person has Lyme disease. Our studies are what are called prospective studies, so we start with a patient when everyone agree they have Lyme disease, they have the rash of Lyme disease. It's usually June and July, like you were saying, is the seasonal time. And so we know they start with Lyme disease, we know they get treated, but then we follow the patients for 2 years, and they're able to, again, dissect out the patients that get better versus those that don't get better, and to begin examining why that is. What is it about one patient that gets the exact same treatment and gets better versus another patient who gets the exact same treatment and still has those lingering symptoms, the fatigue, cognitive complaints, musculoskeletal pain that defines this syndrome that's called post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome.
Do you have a theory going into this, Dr. Aucott?
We have some hypotheses. We think that Lyme disease, it's the balance between the infection and the human immune response, and so we're really focused on the immune response to the infection, and that, of course, is what is a primary driver of how people recover from an illness. So that's our strength is immune system responses, but we also work with people that look at the microbe, the bacteria itself, and we think it's a balance. We don't have a preconceived notion of what the actual answer is. That's why we're doing the research.
John Smarr.
Yeah, absolutely, and Dr. Aucott, John Smarr here. Thank you so much for coming on. And I think a natural question that anyone listening to the radio show is going to be, especially with, you've already answered some of my questions about a little bit more detail about what you're going to be doing, but some people are probably going to be thinking, hey, sign me up. So is this something that, say, you are, do you have any sense of if you're going to be accepting referrals for this, or is it more within your own practice or other related practices where you have people that you've diagnosed with Lyme and then you're going to follow them forward?
So these are research protocols that people can apply for, and there are certain inclusion and exclusion criteria. It's very important to point out these are not treatment trials. We're not in a position yet to do drug treatment trials. These are descriptive studies using standard of care therapy. And the reason for that is because one of the big holy grails in Lyme disease is a blood test that will help determine whether somebody's better or not after their Lyme disease. And we don't have what's called a biomarker. So, you know, as you know, think of prostate cancer. We have a PSA. When you're treated for prostate cancer, your PSA comes down and your doctor can guide you on whether the therapy's worked or not. We don't have a similar biomarker for Lyme disease, so it's a little premature in our belief to talk about treatment trials until we have a blood marker that can be followed to see if the treatments are working. So our focus now is on these blood biomarkers for better diagnosis and also monitoring response to therapy.
I think on a previous episode of Midday on Health with John Smarr, John, we talked about doctors listening to patients, hearing what patients have to say and how important that is. But it seems like a lot of people in the United States who have had Lyme disease and been through the antibiotic regimen have been shouting at the medical community to pay more attention to symptoms that continue after they've been through that antibiotic treatment. So is that what's happening here, Dr. Aucott? Is that what's represented by your research and this center?
I mean, that's what drives up my passion to do this research. It's seen patients in my clinical practice before that were treated appropriately and yet didn't get better. And I think there was this misconception that just because the symptoms are not entirely visible. In other words, the person doesn't have a broken arm or a cancer that you can see on a CAT scan. There's this misconception that the symptoms aren't important, and they can be over a huge range, but they can be devastating. I mean, I'm following several patients right now that have had to drop out of college because of the impact of the symptoms. So, you know, I think a part of the problem is, you're exactly right, listening to the patients and realizing that their symptoms can be have a profound health impact on their quality of life, even though we don't have a blood test or a CAT scan that helps define at this point what exactly is causing it.
Yeah, and I think the key thing there is, a lot of times I'm sure we both have seen plenty of folks who they've been online, they've heard different terminology, they may have gone to the CDC's website, but they may have gone to other websites or other areas and gotten different information. And so sometimes I think one of the challenges is you have patients who go see a clinician, and the clinician may be saying, you know, I don't think you have the symptoms you're experiencing are due to a chronic infection. They may be due to something else. And then what people sometimes hear then is that you're essentially saying that you're dismissing their symptoms in some way, which is, and I think that's a very important statement, Dr. Akhut, that you just made, because it's, even though we're dealing a lot of times with subjective symptoms, these are very important, and these can have very profound life effects to people. And it's important to understand that and respect that, and then be very clear about what our approach is to figure out what's going on. Because obviously, mm-hmm. at the end of the day, all of us want the best thing for the patients and see what we can do. We don't want to miss anything. And so that's the thing I think is great about this research, is we're trying to figure out, are there other things that, if it's not a chronic persistent infection, are there other things that we can figure out what's going on that are causing the symptoms? And then potentially, can we ultimately come up with treatments for that or things that we can do?
I think I appreciate you saying that, John Smarr, because in my experience with this issue as a radio talk show host, as a newspaper columnist, that has been it, that people think that we're being dismissive of their ailments by saying, you know, the mainstream science, the Infectious Disease Society of America says, you know, there's no such thing as chronic Lyme disease. And people hear that and think you're being dismissive of them, that it's a figment of their imagination, that they're not actually in pain of some kind. What I've heard doctors say, specialists in infectious diseases, such as yourself and others who've been on the show, is that, yeah, we can't say that yet. We're not sure yet. So far, there's no evidence, but that doesn't mean you're not suffering some kind of pain. Dr. Akhut?
Yeah, and that's exactly why this research center was started. You know, we do have hints, both Dr. Alan Steer up at Mass General in Boston and our group as well. We have definite hints now that there are alterations in the immune system response in the people that develop prolonged symptoms in this post-treatment Lyme group. So we're getting the first hints that there's a real biology here, that, you know, the patients have been told often that it's all in their heads. And I think we've got the first inklings that there really is an inflammatory dysregulation of the immune system going on. And this is the group in Boston and ours both. So that I think it's all about measurement. It's about teasing apart what's going on and knowing precisely what types of patients we're studying and then finding out what's driving their symptoms.
Does everyone get that rash in the bullseye? Do you need that in order to have had Lyme disease?
Absolutely not.
No?
I mean, so we do big prospective studies. June and July are about 80% of our cases, and not everyone has a rash. The estimates vary between 70 and 80% of people will have the rash. The other big misdiagnosis is based on, people are looking for that Target store lesion you see on the side of the Target department store with
yeah.
the bullseye.
Yeah.
That's only about 20 or 30% of the rashes. They're usually just round and red, uniformly red, and people often mistake them for a spider bite or a bug bite. They're big. They're usually 5 centimeters or larger and get bigger, but they don't often have that kind of Target store ring within a ring appearance.
And if we look at a map of infections in the United States today, Dr. Akhut, what does it look like? I've seen various depictions. Some people believe it's a dark cloud moving over the whole country.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to the CDC website, you see something different like that. You see some heavy clouds here and light clouds in different parts of the country. What does the U.S. map look like in terms of the spread of this disease?
Sure. So there's three centers. On the far west coast, upper northern California is one center. The upper Midwest in Minnesota and Wisconsin is another center. And then the biggest one is the I-95 corridor from Maine to northern Virginia. And that's started along the coast on the I-95 corridor and all the metropolitan areas around there and is now moving west. Ohio is kind of in the vice grip eventually. It's spreading down from upper Midwest and westward from the East Coast towards Ohio. But those are the three main areas. It's much less common in the southern states, even though, it's paradoxical. The ticks that spread Lyme disease are present in the southern states, but they seem to transmit it less often. So there are cases in southern states, but not nearly the magnitude of cases from Virginia northward. So we're in the epicenter here, where this is the Chernobyl of Lyme disease, right? Maryland all the way up into Maine.
And is there a part of the body that the deer tick prefers over other parts of the body? Is there any consistency or pattern there?
Yeah, the ticks are quite small, size of a poppy seed this time of the year, so they're very hard to see, and they don't want to be found, so they tend to hide behind the knee, in the groin, under the armpits, areas where you're not going to see them. It's unusual, for instance, to get a tick bite on the back of your hand because you would see it there or feel it there, but behind the knees is a classic location.
John, what do you say? John Smart, what did you want to say about that?
No, it's just, it's
they've
it's,
adapted the tick. They figured out that you could see them easily in certain places.
Well, the way the ticks get around are by something called chemotaxis. Essentially, they detect substances. And so if you can think of areas where you're maybe sweatier or a little bit darker or moister, that's where they go for. And these are actually important things to know, because not only, obviously at the end of the day, the best thing you can do to prevent yourself from being exposed to Lyme disease is to screen yourself for ticks, especially if you're doing high-risk things. And so if you're looking on yourself or, say, on your children, these are all the places that you have to look to do a good tick check. It's not like most of the time. And that could contribute to some of the people who never see this target-like rash that mm-hmm. we were just talking about, is it may be on a spot on your body that you didn't actually see where the tick was to begin with.
Dr. Arkrab, before you leave us here, some folks listening in today may be wondering whether they could fit into your research. What do you have to say generally about to the public with regard to the way your center will function and who you're interested in?
Right. So right now, this is our peak season for early Lyme disease studies, so we're actively recruiting patients with the Lyme rash, and the next 2 months is the busy season. So we are looking for people interested in our research protocols who have an active rash lesion, a round red lesion bigger than 2 to 3 inches, and those people we encourage to look into our research opportunities. We're on the website in the Division of Rheumatology at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, and we're here at Green Spring Station where we see the patients. So I would encourage people to look into our studies, absolutely.
That's Dr. John Aucott, AUCOTT. Thank you very much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. John Aucott, director of the new Lyme Disease Clinical Research Center, as he said, at the Division of Rheumatology at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Dr. John Smart is with us. This is Midday on Health. If you have questions about Lyme disease, what we've discussed so far, I have some questions that just came in by email for Dr. Smart. 410-662-8780 is our phone number. The email address for Midday is midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us a question, MiddayWYPR or Dan Rodericks. A short break on the show. We'll be right back. A little bit later on in the show, we're going to follow up with Dr. Smart today on a story that Morning Edition on NPR had last week about a man who died in New Jersey of a fever. And although the cause of the death was officially Lassa fever, L-A-S-S-A, Lassa fever, it was reported that the man was being monitored for Ebola. That'll be part of an Ebola update we do a little bit later on in the show. For now, we're talking about Lyme disease, and what occasions that was our conversation just now with Dr. John Aucott. April 1st, Hopkins announced the establishment of a new research clinic for Lyme disease. I didn't ask him this question, John, but mm-hmm. it seems like this is a sort of a once and for all kind of effort here. For once and for all, to answer the question, are there symptoms from Lyme disease that linger for a long time after you've been treated with the antibiotics? Is that a real thing? Is it attributable to the infection?
Right.
From the spirochete. Right?
Yeah, and I think the nice thing about his study, when you look more and especially talking with him, getting the details, is it's really, it's sort of, I think some people would probably use the word finally, that finally we have a reputable center that clearly has money behind it. We have a study that seems like its aims are noble and well designed, and they are in the best way. The best type of research that you can do is do, as he said, a prospective study. So you start with somebody who has the target lesion, the erythema migrans rash. So that's the first sign of someone getting an infection, and then treating them, and not necessarily doing experimental stuff from that standpoint, but going ahead and treating them and then just see what happens. Because the key piece is the majority of people who get the Lyme infection end up getting and get antibiotics appropriately. They end up being completely fine. All their symptoms go away, and they go about their lives and have no other problems. In fact, I've seen several folks who have had multiple times over the years where they've had a tick bite, and they've gotten the rash, and they had Lyme disease, and they got the antibiotics. And even though they've had it multiple times, they feel perfectly fine.
Wow.
But then there is this...
And each time they were treated the same way.
Yes, and each time they got the same treatment, so they didn't get months and months and months of antibiotics, but they got sort of the appropriate few weeks of antibiotics. But then there is this small but significant group of people who we know they're officially diagnosed with Lyme disease. They get the appropriate antibiotics, and then for weeks, maybe months, maybe in some cases years afterwards, they still have a lot of these symptoms. And we use the phrase subjective symptoms because, like Dr. Alcott said, it's not like you can look at them and you say, oh, you've got a broken arm, or you have something obvious that I can see that's wrong with you. But it's the way that you're feeling. It's issues with pain and fatigue, and people talk about cognitive things. And that's the piece that is sort of the key for us to try to understand, because some people who have been proponents of this idea of chronic Lyme disease have used that phrase to mean we give you antibiotics and you still have symptoms, so you must have an infection. Yet all the well-done evidence that we have to this point does not show that there's any evidence that if people get the appropriate antibiotics, that the infection continues. But that's not to say that there's something about the infection after you've killed it with the antibiotics that is still causing these symptoms. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, and we've even discussed this before, it's been speculated that it's something to do with our immune system continuing to react to maybe the dead bodies, if you will, for simple terms, of the bacteria in our body. And maybe that has something to do with the symptoms, or maybe it changes something about our immune response in some way that makes us feel sick. And most of these folks, it seems like eventually they get better, but there is, a significant smaller group of folks who do not seem to having these symptoms go away. And so a study that's now trying to say, okay, we're going to diagnose you and we're going to know that there's no question about your diagnosis, that's one. And then we're going to treat you the appropriate way, that's two. In the people who then end up getting symptoms, and even in the people who don't, let's do blood tests and look at different things about you to see, is something changing about your immune system? Mm-hmm. And can we line that up with the people who still have symptoms? And maybe out of this, can we figure out a better diagnostic test that we can use to begin with? And as he had mentioned, we're not at a point of thinking about looking for new treatments in this particular group, but who knows, maybe something new, and maybe a treatment to try to modulate whatever is causing these symptoms. That's the theory. That, I think, is where this is a promising thing to be looking at.
It may also turn out that people who go through Dr. Alcott's clinic and his research have symptoms of ailments completely unrelated to Lyme disease? Is that possible?
It's possible, but at least from what he was telling us, they really want an objective starting point. And I think why you bring that up is very important, because especially to someone in your situation where you're not clinically seeing patients, you're just covering this, you have your own strong personal interest in it,
right,
and you hear different things about mm-hmm. the supposed aspects of these controversies, is that a lot of folks who identify who with the concept of having chronic Lyme disease or post-Lyme treatment syndrome. Sometimes as a physician, when you sit down with them, you sort of look back and you figure out, actually, I don't even think you had Lyme disease to begin with. And I'm not saying that's all of them, but sometimes that's the case. Because a lot of times people say, you know, I'm feeling a certain way, and they get they either told by someone, or they come to the conclusion maybe that I have Lyme disease, and that isn't the same thing as being officially diagnosed with it. And so it makes it even more confusing, because
it is.
You can have a starting point where people are feeling in a way that seems to match with these symptoms.
But his starting point is
right.
If not the bullseye, the establishment of the infection.
Right, right. The objective establishment that is what's going on.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. So that's what we'll get. That's very significant.
Yes.
As opposed to someone who says, you know, I've been depressed, chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, name it, all those other things that have been, rheumatoid arthritis that have been associated with Lyme disease.
Precisely. Right. And I don't know what his specific, say, exclusion criteria are that he mentioned, but that's sort of the theme. Yeah.
Let's take a couple of questions for Dr. John Smarr on the subject of Lyme disease. Melody, calling from the Eastern Shore, Kent Island. Melody, you're on Midday.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had what they thought was Lyme disease, and they took blood and tested it. No, it wasn't Lyme disease. So they sent the blood to a rheumatologist, and he came back and said that I had ehrlichiosis.
John is nodding. Yes.
Yes.
I mean, is that like I don't even know how you spell that. Do you know? Ehrlichiosis.
Yes.
Okay.
Ehrlichiosis.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. And John's familiar with that. So.
Yeah. Okay. I actually have a friend whose last name is Ehrlich, but that's a completely separate issue.
We had a governor that name.
Right. Well, I was going to say that as well, too.
Yeah.
But the
yeah.
So the issue is that, and this gets into, so it turns out, and it depends geographically where you are in the United States, but bacteria that causes Lyme disease is, of course, not the only thing that you can get from a tick. And so there are a bunch of, and you can Google, and in fact, the terminology that sometimes is used to refer to this is the idea of a co-infection. And I kind of hesitate even to bring that up because some people misuse that word. But it's the idea that in certain areas of the country, you can have ticks that may contain the bacteria that can cause Lyme disease. It contains an organism that can give humans something called babesiosis. There are things called ehrlichosis and anaplasmosis. And all of these are different organisms, be they bacteria or parasites, that can cause infections in human beings. And so depending on your particular symptoms, it's something that you can be diagnosed with. And sometimes the treatment is very similar to what causes for the treatment for Lyme disease. And in some cases, it can be different. But it's an important thing that doctors need to understand, you know, what area of the country you're in and how sick the person is and what kind of symptoms they have.
Melody, I'm curious about your symptoms. If you don't mind, could you describe them for us? Did you feel sick?
Sure. I didn't have really any kind of, I couldn't find a Lyme bite, a tick bite on me anywhere. And but I developed a fever, a low-grade fever that kept getting higher, and I had terrific headaches, just awful headache. And finally, that led to vomiting, and when I ran out of stuff to use for that, they sent me to the hospital where I worked, actually. And the doctors kept looking until they finally decided to send this information to a rheumatologist, and that's how they figured it out. But it was really miserable for about a month until everybody got their act together and figured out what it was.
And you definitely remember being bit by a tick.
No, I don't.
Oh, you don't?
No, there was no mark at all. We live in a wooded area, so we're always looking for ticks. And no marks at all, but they just thought it was Lyme's disease because everybody else had it.
Right. And the thing about ehrlichiosis, at least, is it doesn't tend to set up these, if you don't get treated right away, it's not one of these things that, like Lyme, would lead to massive arthritis. It makes you feel very sick. And actually, the symptoms that Melody is describing are very, very common among people who have this. Unfortunately for this one, doxycycline, which is one of the main oral antibiotics you give for Lyme disease, also can work for ehrlichiosis as well.
Rick in Manchester, in Carroll County. Rick, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Go right ahead.
I've got some questions. I'm battling something right now. I'm not sure what it is. I've been to probably 10 to 12 different specialists, rheumatologists, hematologists. I've had about 6 or 7 different MRIs, a variety of different tests, and they cannot figure out what's wrong with me. I've done a lot of reading and research on Lyme disease on the internet, and basically what I found out that is the initial blood test they give you, what's called the ELISA, is very unreliable, and depending on what stage of Lyme you have, it'll come up negative more often than not. I'm trying to get what's called a Western blot test done, and no doctor will give it to me because my ELISA test keeps on coming up negative. I work outside all day. I've had ticks on me before. I have a lot of neurological-type symptoms going on, and nobody can figure out what's wrong with me.
Okay. Just before you go there, and we get Dr. Smar's response to that, when you say neurological issues...
Correct.
Like, give me an example, Rick. How does this affect
I've
you?
I've got burning sensations running through my body. I've got peripheral neuropathy on my left leg where I have no feeling or sensation to the touch on my left leg. I can barely walk. If I start exerting myself a little bit, when I say exerting, like walking downstairs, I can't even walk through a store right now. That's starting to stagger and fall down.
Wow.
Things of this nature.
How old are you, Rick?
52.
Let's hear from Dr. Smar on that. The two things he referenced there, an ELISA test and the Western blot test. I'm more familiar with the second than the first.
Right, and so this actually can go into a comment I wanted to make on what Dr. Aucott was talking about with regards to a biomarker with regards to that for testing for Lyme. But essentially, one of the issues we have is the testing that we have that has been validated and approved by the FDA starts out with something called an ELISA test. And essentially what that is it's looking for levels of antibodies to the Lyme disease bacteria in your body. And it comes back with a number. So this is a test when you order it, and what the doctor gets back is they get a number in a range of numbers. And the challenge with it is that there is a scenario whereby if you get bitten early by it, if you get bitten by the tick and then you get treated early, it's possible that you might get treated early enough that you kill off the bug before your immune system makes a response, which is what the test is detecting. So that way you could get that rash, you could get treated right away, and then maybe someone would do the test on you later, and you didn't actually have a chance to make antibodies. So it is possible that there are certain scenarios where that test may end up being negative. However, that's really the biggest one of those scenarios. And if someone is truly exposed to the Lyme bacteria, that test should end up being positive. Now, like I said, when that's done, you get a number. And if that number is high enough for them to say, okay, this is a positive test, but there are other infections, other things that could make this positive, then the next step is to do a Western blot test. And what that is it's looking for antibodies to not just in general, it's not like a yes or no, but it's looking to antibodies that are against certain specific pieces or antigens from the bacteria. And there's a list of them, and you have to get a certain proportion of those being positive for them to call this test as being a positive test. And the key thing that I think is that they recommend, and I agree with it, that you're not supposed to do the Western blot test if the first test is negative, because there's no reason to think that that Western blot test would be positive if the first one is negative.
But in Rick's case, Rick, you were never treated for Lyme disease, is that right?
Can I interject here?
Yeah.
I've done extensive research on this. There's something called Lyme Literate Medical Doctors. They're rather underground. A lot of them have had their licenses suspended due to how they've gone about treating for Lyme. A lot of Lyme disease diagnosis is what's called clinical diagnosis, where they're not really necessarily relying on inaccurate blood tests, such as the ELISA, and start going more for the more advanced tests.
Well, Rick, my question to you was, you were never treated for Lyme disease.
That's correct.
Okay, all right, so that's what I wanted to establish. So he didn't score high enough on the ELISA to move on to the Western blot test.
Right, and so the challenge is that And this is a key thing. So two points. One, I'll get to what Rick was talking about momentarily. But the other one is that we don't have a lot of this is the only testing that we have. And it's true that it's not that great. There are a lot of specialty laboratories that have different testing that you can do for Lyme disease, but they haven't been well validated in the sense that if someone goes and gets it done and they come back with a positive reaction, I don't know what that means. And a lot of times these are things where people have to pay out of pocket because insurance companies don't cover them and they're very expensive. So that's why I said that with Dr. Alcott's work, if one of the things we get out of that is actually a better validated, universally acceptable test than what we have right now, that's really important.
That would be significant.
Yes. Yeah. And then the other last piece I wanted to say about clinically diagnosing Lyme disease is that there is a list of symptoms, of course, that we would typically expect someone to have who has Lyme to have. The challenge is that that's not the only thing that can give you that list of symptoms. And so what can happen often is people will just say that it's challenging just to make the clinical diagnosis in many, many cases. And there are many people who say, oh, I don't need to worry about the test. This clinical diagnosis trumps that. But the problem is that it's a very complex world, lots of medical stuff, and we need both good diagnoses as well as good tests.
Dr. John Smar, our guest for another hour of Midday on Health. We'll be back with some more questions about Lyme disease after this short break, and then we'll also talk about that Lassa fever case from New Jersey. 410-662-8780. A couple more quick questions for Dr. John Smar about Lyme disease. Mary, having had Lyme disease, treated for a month with doxycycline, what am I supposed to think when subsequent blood tests continue to come back positive, although I don't have symptoms anymore?
Right. And so, again, the tests that we're using, the FDA approved this ELISA, this Western blot, these are, if they are accurate, they are antibodies, and these should be positive for life. And so that also makes it challenging because it's certainly possible, as we mentioned before, for someone to get Lyme disease, be treated, be fine, and then say the next year get bitten by a tick and get Lyme disease again. And that's one of the things that what Dr. Alcott was talking about with regards to a biomarker. What he means is a blood test that gives us, say, a number. And when we treat someone, we know that when that number goes down, that means they're responding to treatment. But then let's say they get exposed again next year and that number goes back up, that means that someone's been reinfected and needs more treatment. And so that's what he's talking about with regards to that.
Another one regarding the biomarker or the blood marker. Can a biomarker or a blood marker pick up an episode of Lyme from the past? I was, Annette's writing to us, to say, I was lucky to have an obvious bullseye rash in the year 2000 and was treated immediately with antibiotics. Can a marker show up even though I was treated? Or is that one of the things they're trying to figure out at Hopkins?
Right. Well, it's sort of the flip side of what I was talking about before. Yeah. You can be, if you're treated early, it may be that your body doesn't make that immune response. But if your body does make that immune response and you get tested 15 years later, then certainly we could see that with the testing.
Is it true that there is a human Lyme vaccine that isn't available simply because it's not profitable enough for Big Pharma? A question from Michael.
It is true that there was a human vaccine for Lyme disease, and I was not paying attention back, I think it was at least 12 to 13 years ago when it was taken off the market, but because I was earlier in my clinical training. But the ostensible reason why we don't have that anymore is because there wasn't actually enough of a demand for it in terms of the drug company feeling like it wanted to continue to produce that. So whether or not you interpret that, that's up for other people to decide.
Sarah, your question for Dr. Smar. Go right ahead. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. It's a fascinating show. I had Lyme disease 20 years ago. I was 2 weeks after being bitten by a tick. I got very sick. I got the classic symptoms, and my doctor gave me a 2-week course of antibiotics, and I asked for a third. I was so scared, and she reluctantly complied. And since then, I've been blood tested, and I think with the Western blot test, although I'd have to verify that, and I still have the marker. I still have the marker. So that was a year later. That was now almost 20 years ago. And my question is, Is your clinical research study interested in these old cases and what you were just talking about? I mean, the clinic at Johns Hopkins, excuse me. And what you were just talking about was that you could have it again. And I indeed do have, you know, some symptoms that are resist diagnosis and that are really problematic, joint pain and fatigue and muscle soreness and things like this. And I'm just wondering if the older cases are of interest to the clinic at this point.
Well, right. She'd have to actually address Dr. Aucott.
Right, but
Dr. Smar is here.
But I do think the sense that I get, again, is they're looking for people who are not having symptoms to start with or have had Lyme disease before. They're looking at new diagnoses now.
That's the impression I got from him.
Right. Yeah. And so the other piece is, again, the studies that have been done to date, and there's a reason why he's not specifically looking at this right now, is that it seems like, again, it doesn't seem that if you've been treated with antibiotics that the bacteria does persist in your body if you've had an appropriate course of antibiotics.
I wanted to follow up here on Ebola with John Smar in this hour of midday on health as well. Interesting story this morning. A person who had recently returned from West Africa was admitted yesterday to Johns Hopkins Hospital complaining of a fever. Officials said it did not appear the person had an Ebola infection. Although the Washington Post, I'm referring here to the Baltimore Sun story, the Washington Post story said a person with Ebola-like symptoms was picked up from the intersection of North Avenue and Maryland Avenue in Baltimore yesterday by personnel wearing hazmat gear. So thus
that sounds dramatic.
Yeah, the suggestion. That patient is said to have recently returned from Sierra Leone. Officials declined to provide further details to the Sun, citing patient confidentiality under rules imposed last fall, you'll remember. Travelers from countries in West Africa affected by Ebola are subject to monitoring for 21 days, which includes reporting their body temperatures. In a statement, Hopkins said safety of patients, their families, and other visitors is the hospital's top priority. We also have a statement here from the City Health Department saying that out of an abundance of caution, I'm sorry, this is a Hopkins statement. Out of an abundance of caution and as part of our practice protocol, when a patient presents with a relevant travel history and meets screening criteria for Ebola evaluations, we begin instituting safety precautions and work with the Maryland Department of Health, the City Health Department, as well as the CDC to evaluate the patient. That's the statement from Hopkins, John.
And that's actually a really good point because there's some drama a little bit in the article there. But what I can tell you also from personal experience is that travelers are still being monitored with, as we've discussed previously on the show, if you come back from the areas, and of course now Liberia has been declared Ebola-free, but if you're coming back from an affected country, you're still monitoring your temperature twice a day and you're reporting to someone for those 21 days. And we have had, and certainly this sounds like a case where someone then gets a fever and is sent into the hospital for evaluation. So this is actually not unusual, and in all of those cases thus far, it's not been Ebola that's been the cause of that.
Correct.
Fever.
We have no confirmed cases.
Right.
NPR's Morning Edition had a story, I don't know if you got to hear this last week, about a man who died in New Jersey of a hemorrhagic fever. Although the cause of death was officially this Lassa fever, L-A-S-S-A, it was reported that the man was being monitored for Ebola. This is from NPR's Jason Bobian.
The 55-year-old New Jersey resident worked in the mining industry and traveled frequently to West Africa. 2 weeks ago, he landed at JFK International Airport for the final time after a grueling flight from Liberia. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, he was screened for Ebola when he landed and did not have a fever. Along with everyone else arriving from what's designated as an Ebola-affected country, he was ordered to undergo a 21-day monitoring program by his local health department. He was supposed to be reporting his temperature daily and to notify county health authorities if he got a fever. But when his temperature surged the day after he landed, he didn't do that. Instead, he went to St. Barnabas Medical Center in Livingston, New Jersey.
According to the hospital, he was asked whether he had been in West Africa and said no.
This is the head of the CDC, Tom Frieden.
And there would be no reason to think of a viral hemorrhagic fever in someone who doesn't have a travel history.
The Ebola monitoring system does not alert local hospitals that someone on Ebola watch is in their vicinity and might walk through their doors. The doctors at St. Barnabas gave the man antibiotics and sent him home. Then, as his condition deteriorated, it's not exactly clear what happened. A spokesperson for the New Jersey Department of Health declined a request for an interview about this case, saying they're still investigating what occurred. She did, however, say the man was actively being monitored. If the man was lying to his case manager, officials would have no way to know he was sick.
If, okay, this is all hypothetical, if this had been an Ebola case.
Lori Garrett is a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of The Coming Plague.
If the individual had gone to a hospital and not acknowledged that he had been in Liberia and so on, and it had turned out to be Ebola, that would indeed have been a major failure of the screening system and potentially very dangerous to his healthcare providers.
What he did have was Lassa fever, a hemorrhagic fever similar to Ebola and common in West Africa. He returned to the hospital 3 days after his first visit, acknowledged that he'd been in Liberia, and was transferred to an isolation unit. The man died 4 days later. Garrett says going back for centuries, communities have struggled with what measures are appropriate to keep diseases at bay.
It has always been a fine line to figure out what are the protective measures that will work and how far you should go into abrogating the civil liberties of individuals.
Do you quarantine everyone coming off the plane, or do you take them at their word? Since October, 17,000 people across the U.S. have been monitored for Ebola after returning from West Africa. None of them came down with it. New Jersey officials are now monitoring anyone who had close contact with the Lassa victim, including healthcare workers, for possible signs of the disease. Jason Beaubien, NPR News.
Interesting. So, John,
yes.
Based on that, would you say there's a hole in the system? Not a major failing of the system, but certainly that exposes a hole in it somewhere.
You could use that terminology. I think I would push back a little bit against using that description, because it comes down to, and it's weird because it recapitulates sort of the discussions that were happening months ago about what should we do with regards to travel bans and what kind of duress do you put people who are coming back to the U.S. from that area of from Africa on.
West Africa.
And right now we settled on what is very reasonable, which is a voluntary reporting system. I mean, when these people are being monitored, what happens is you get this packet from the CDC, you get a thermometer, you're supposed to be checking your temperature twice a day, and then you verbally check in with someone at the health department level. And so it's easy for you, if someone lies, then it's going to circumvent the entire system. But I think another piece is that they said 17,000 people.
Yeah, it's a big number.
That's a big number. And are you really going to the amount of data? Like, imagine, say, someone comes from Sierra Leone and comes to Baltimore, or in a month you have 100 people, and I'm just completely making up a number. So who then are you proposing, if you're going to take it to a further level, are you proposing to notify? Are you saying that?
Yeah, I'm trying to imagine. What am I saying the hole is? The hole would be that you didn't notify every hospital in the Baltimore metropolitan area.
Because you know what every hospital is going to say is, we're going to say, that's nice, we don't care, it's not reasonable to us to be the curators of that information. It's one, there are privacy issues. Two, it's a hospital is not going to be worried about it, because probably in most areas of the country, most populous areas, you have people who are returning,
right,
who have been recently to West Africa. And so I feel like what we're doing is a compromise in a very challenging situation, and it's one that's been effective so far. Mm-hmm. But it can be subverted if, for whatever reason, if somebody chooses not to be truthful. But
I'm trying to imagine what that reason would be.
Right, and
you were just lazy. You didn't
fear too.
Fear.
If someone just is in denial, maybe that this is a process that's happening to them. That's a big driver.
Interesting. Thank you very much. No confirmed cases. That's a good thing.
John
Smarr, who joins us here once a month on Midday for Midday on Health, has been contributing to our show the last few years. He's based at Sinai Hospital and a specialist in infectious diseases. John, nice to have you with us.
Always wonderful, Dan. Thank you.
Yep. Please enjoy lunch from Rosina Gourmet. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in this afternoon. If you have any further questions on Lyme disease, we'll forward them to Dr. Smarr. It's midday at WYPR.org. See you again tomorrow for another edition of our show.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Aaron Morenzi, Aaliyah Satterfield, Kaylee Sadek, and Campbell Reed. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.